Argue, argue, talk, 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 exaggerate, argue, pontificate, argue, just talk, shut talk, up. Why won't you listen? Why won't you see? I know the story, just listen to me.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
Well, good afternoon. It is truly the beginning of spring. Actually, we're already into spring. Spring has sprung. And you are listening to Spouting Off. Now's your chance to spout off. Actually, I have a terrific guest coming on at around the 20-minute interval. But I always like to do my own little spouting off about what's in the news. I love the little bites of big issues, but if I were to even touch on some of the issues, and I'm going to, they're going to be little bites of enormous, huge issues. They're all huge going on, and that's why there's plenty of room for talk show hosts of all shapes and sizes to weigh in on the issues, and your humble host is no different. Couple of things going on, like I think since the last time I spoke to you, the Horowitz has put out his first report on McCabe, who was fired. If you're following that, it's a gnarly mess. But there is a couple of things that you can boil it down to. The Horowitz, the Mueller, Fusion GPS, there's all these buzzwords to a story that just keeps growing and growing and growing. And the way to boil it down, because I don't have a five-hour show, and of course, like most people, I have a life. At least I'm proud to say I do. And that is that Mueller, the special prosecutor Mueller, if that's his actual title, has been investigating a crime that is not a crime. Colluding with Russians, with a foreign country, is a made-up crime. There is no crime. It is not a crime for either a president or a presidential candidate to talk to and to get information from a country, whether it's Russia or Venezuela or Italy. It's not a crime. Unfortunately, people do not know that. And so they're sure that they're going to get something on Trump. There is nothing that, as I said on Facebook not too long ago, never in memory has a president, a public figure, or a politician, which thank God Trump really isn't, never has anybody been subjected to the proctology exam that has been done on Donald Trump in order to destroy him, to destroy his administration, to take away the votes of millions and millions of people that wanted a sea change in Washington, D.C., and they just keep throwing stuff up to see if it'll stick. That's what they do. I call it Linguini. They just keep throwing up the linguini to see what's going to stick on the wall. So not only are they investigating a crime that is not a crime, but they used a phony dossier, which was a lie, to get a FISA warrant in order to do so. Those are two of the important things to remember. There's a flip side to this story, as you well know. Everything they're doing to Donald Trump, which is made up, hyped up, and a frame job, actually happened on the Democrat side. It actually happened, right? They really were colluding with Russians. What kind of collusion? What was a crime? Well, Hillary was paying for, and her campaign and the DNC, she was colluding with the DNC, and there's supposed to be an arm's length separation between those two. And Donna Brazile in her book admitted that Hillary was running the DNC. Hillary, with her money, was controlling the DNC. That's a crime. What else is a crime is laundering money. What else is a crime is selling political favors and selling 20% of our uranium to the Russians. The Russians, where have I heard that before? So pretty much everything these Trump haters, and that includes a good many Republicans, are doing, pretty much everything that they've accused Donald Trump of doing is stuff that they did. And they are guilty of crimes. They most certainly are. And we can only hope and pray that it's going to come out. Now, a couple other things that are going on, really tiny issues, like the fact that we did a surgical strike of Syria since I last spoke to you. I couldn't possibly do a monologue to even get into it because it's complex, another gnarly subject, and I'm not an expert on it. And you know what? I don't think very many people in the grassroots, which I consider myself to be, really are experts, because we're depending on the same phony media that's been lying to us all the time. Now, I do have my suspicions, and I'll tell you what my main suspicion is. Let me preface this by saying that if you're going to bomb Syria, if you're going to decide to do it, doing it the way Trump and his administration did it would have been the best way. Now, am I convinced? I don't mind destroying chemical weapons plants in Syria. I really don't. But my question is, it's not clear who is responsible. I just don't know. And here's the thing that makes me suspicious. The Democrats have been urging Donald Trump, whom they hate with a purple passion, to bomb Syria. The Democrats have been threatening a regime change in Syria without a plan as to who would come back. Who would replace Assad as leader. And that is deadly mistaken, because every time they've finally done something, and it's usually not bombing, it's usually bribery and blackmail behind the scenes, you get a dictator who's 10 times worse. So anything the Democrats want you to do should be suspect right away, especially if they want Trump to do it. Thirdly, Scooter Libby was pardoned. Now, this is another huge issue that we could take a lot of time with, but I'm going to tell you about our guest before we break, and we've got more time, so that you'll know why I've decided to give so much time to this issue of my guest coming up. And I'm just delighted that he's agreed to join us. The reason Scooter Libby is an important thing is because, again, you have to ask yourself, why did Trump do it and why did he do it now? Did he do it to show up George W. Bush? Could be. Did he do it to befriend Cheney, who was furious at Bush for not giving Scooter Libby a full pardon? Because Scooter Libby was scapegoated in that story. I don't have time to get into it. He was scapegoated completely. In fact, it was public knowledge that he wasn't responsible, and yet he was charged anyway. That's kind of what we've got going on now. People being charged for crimes in an investigation when the investigation itself was bogus. I mean, that's what we got to deal with today. It's great for talk radio, but I think for the for justice, it's a travesty. Did Trump want to telegraph to Mueller that loyal people are going to be protected with either pardons or something else? Did he want to telegraph to the people Mueller is threatening, like his own lawyer, Cohen, that they will be protected? Just because it was the right thing to do. Maybe that's the reason that he pardoned Scooter Libby. So we're going to keep a close watch on that. And now I got to get to something I want to spend a little time on, because it leads to so much. Make no mistake, we will choose one of these issues in the future. We're watching all this stuff very carefully. And I If you'd like to call in the next 5 minutes, I'll take your call, but then we're going to have a guest. So the number to call toll free is 888-627-6008 if you'd like to weigh in on any of those issues. But here's what I wanted to spend a little time with on before the break. I have a lot of respect for the academic. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him, Victor Davis Hanson. Smart, smart man. He's on Tucker Carlson all the time. I got to watch him actually teach a class at Hillsdale College. He's the quintessential academic. And he wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal in which he said he was never a Trump lover, that's for sure. But he says that Trump's very flaws may be his strengths. Now, Victor Davis Hanson is a really smart man. It is not his intellect I'm going to take issue with, but I love arguing and I like disagreeing because that's why I love talk radio. Why agree with people all the time? You got to come up with your own ideas, right? So here's what bothers me. I agree with him fundamentally on his point that, in fact, his very flaws are his strengths. What people see as his flaw is his lack of polish and statesmanship. Oh, that they don't like his style. And it has been that very style that has endeared him to his supporters because it reminds them every day and twice on Shabbos, that's instead of twice on Sunday, that he's not an insider. He's not a politician. He is a businessman. Not only is he a businessman, but he's a product of the very thing Republicans have said that is superior to government bureaucracy and government control. He's a product of free markets. He's a product of competition. He's a product of private enterprise. He's a product of success. He didn't succeed by being a wimp. He didn't succeed by being an idiot. And yet the Democrats have tried to paint him as everything, all rolled up in one. He is a wimp. He's lazy. He's brilliant. He's conniving. He's dishonest. If one of these days I'm going to look up, if you'd like to help me, I would love for you to help me. If you'd like to help me come up with a list, because you can't get it online, especially with Google that controls your search engines. But I'd love to come up with a list of the primary accusations that have been leveled against Donald J. Trump and how many of them are contradictory. How many of them don't even make sense in the context of the same person. But it's just like the O.J. Simpson trial. They threw up whatever they could on the wall to see what stuck. And the people that were judging that case weren't bothered by the fact that the same people that accused the L.A. Police Department of corruption were the same people that accused them of being incompetent boobs. Now, you know, it takes a certain amount of competence to be corrupt. You know, if you're going to be a successful corrupt, you know, it takes a little intelligence. But they didn't care about the contradictions. I care about the contradictions. So getting back to Victor Davis Hanson, who is a smart man, he uses his piece in the Wall Street Journal to explain to people that the very talents that he has, you know, clearly, I interrupted myself. Clearly, Victor Davis Hanson does not like Donald Trump's style. He just doesn't. He doesn't like him. He thinks he is uncouth, and he thinks that he's, oh my goodness. I mean, he just doesn't like it. Let me see if I can find. I'm rustling papers here. Oh, here. But whether he could be of service at the opportune time and right place for this country, crude as he is. So he calls him crude. He calls him, you know, with a dubious past. I'd like to know what he thinks of a whole lot of other politicians. We only found out about their dubious past, you know, 50 years later, as in JFK. A lot of politicians have dubious pasts, but they are not subjected to the proctology exam that Donald Trump has been, nor have the loose-moraled, trash-talking, trash culture of the left have never been bothered by any of those behaviors anywhere else. Donald Trump has turned the left into a bunch of Puritans for the simple sake of being able to destroy Donald Trump. Does anybody notice that? Am I the only one who notices? I'm sure I am not. I am not that egotistical to think that I'm the only one who appreciates, and you can find a lot of writers online or wherever and on publications, who thinks that Donald Trump has turned these people into Puritans, just like the Me Too movement. You know, first you could have sex like a man, and it's all the same thing, and then suddenly you're a hothouse flower. I've said that before, and we may be talking about that with our next guest. And Victor Davis Hanson concludes by saying that by his very excesses, Trump has already lost. But in his losing, he might alone be able to end some things that long ago should have been ended. Well, you know, here's where, for the first time in a long time, I have to disagree with Victor Davis Hanson. I haven't seen Donald Trump lose yet. I've seen him compromise on some stuff. I've seen him do things with which I would disagree. But I don't think he's lost at all. In fact, I think that's what's turning the left into complete lunatics, because they haven't been able to get Donald Trump. They were able to destroy the guy, Herman Cain, with a mere accusation. He didn't even care if it was true and he was out the door. Not that I don't really like Herman Cain, but Donald Trump just doesn't fold. In fact, Donald Trump comes back twice, three times, four times harder, and they can't stand it. Now, some of this is old news, but what I wanted to get to, and we may have to take a few more minutes, Doug, my producer and engineer, I got to take a few more minutes, and then I will adequately and appropriately introduce our guests. Sometimes talk radio has a mind of its own. My listeners in the western states, that being Colorado and Wyoming, had their assembly last week. And there's a lot of political fireworks going on in Colorado right now because of a lot of different things, most of which are a little bit inside baseball in Colorado. But here's what I would like to point out. There was a huge difference between the Democrat convention and the Republican convention. The venue, the presentation, the whole thing. One, it wasn't quite like the Oscars, mind you, but it was done extremely well. It was it paid attention to political theater. You got to admit, the Democrats are great at political theater. And Republicans aren't, because they're more into the ideology. And yet, they respond to the political theater of Democrats on the defensive. If you really want, I'm beginning to come up with a theory of politics, you know, one aspect of it. And that is, you put out political theater. You present it in a form of political theater. I hope I can get back to this again. But you don't get persuaded by it. We have a mentality of expecting our own to have the appearance of statesmanship, and it doesn't really matter what they think. I hope you understand what I'm trying to say here. Political theater is for the other guy. Political theater is what we have to do better to present our ideas. The left, on the other hand, that's all they've got is political theater, messaging, and, you know, putting things in little bite-sized packages, usually that always benefit them. We're going to get back to this idea probably, well, in shows to come. We have our guest on the line. Maybe what I will do is introduce him briefly, and then we will take a break. I am delighted to have with us Dr. Paul Nathanson, who is, I can't wait to hear what, we'll just do the beginning of this, okay, is an intersexual dialogue academic. I really can't wait to hear what that actually is. And he has defined the field of misandry. I don't even know how to pronounce that because nobody talks about it. They talk about misogynists, but they never talk about misandry or misandry. So we'll find out how to pronounce that in our culture. What it has to do with is the war on men. Now, you've heard about the war on women, the war on women, the war on women. Well, the Democrats came up with that idea, and I would submit that whenever the Democrats come up with something like the war on men, it's usually the war on women, it's usually the opposite. They've been waging a war on men for a very long time. So here we have Dr. Paul Nathanson. Welcome to Spouting Off.
Thank you.
After all of that introduction, thank you. I am sorry I was very long-winded there. Please, Dr. Nathanson, give us first an explanation, if you would, please, of intersexual dialogue academic. What is that?
Well, I didn't write those words exactly. Intersexual dialogue, however, relies on the basic model of interreligious dialogue. It's how do we get men and women talking together in such a way that the underlying support comes from empathy, not from hostility. So unlike debate, in which one side wins over the other, which is very useful in courts of law, it's useful in academic discussions, but it doesn't produce reconciliation. Dialogue, however, is something that can promote reconciliation.
Great. And where are you? Are you an academic now? I could not find that on your bio. Forgive me. In a particular higher education place, because I could not find that, and yeah. I want to make sure.
Well, I did research for about 30 years at McGill University in Montreal.
Okay, great. And are we speaking to you from Canada right now?
Yes.
Wonderful. It's great to have guests from Canada. We don't always get guests from Canada. You're also the author of at least four books. And the first one is Spreading Misandry. And how do you pronounce that?
Well, I mean, I don't really care how people pronounce it.
I want to know.
I pronounce it Misandry because I want to make a vocal connection with the word misogyny. Misandry is probably correct, but
well, I'm tickled by it because it's not even in our lexicon, let alone.
That's right.
That's one of the reasons why we don't know how to pronounce it, because nobody even thinks that's a possibility to have.
Well, we didn't invent the word. My colleague and I, Catherine Young, with whom I wrote those four books. We didn't invent the word. The Library of Congress actually has a subject heading, misandry, with about, I don't know, half a dozen books. And under misogyny, they list, you couldn't count the number of books they have on misogyny.
Sure.
My spell check on my computer does not have the word misandry, but of course it has misogyny.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so give us, I was going to say the full title of this book, Spreading Misandry, the Teaching of Contempt for Men in Popular Culture. Then you also have one called Legalizing Misandry, From Public Shame to Systemic Discrimination Against Men. And they look to be a series. So let me just go ahead and say the others, because I'm sure my listeners are going to want to start reading them. Replacing Misandry, A Revolutionary History of Men, and finally, Sanctifying Misandry, Goddess Ideology and the Fall of Man. Those are huge, huge titles. Give us an idea of what you think is the reason that, not the reason, but how, if you had a hardcore leftist who told you you were crazy for thinking that they've been teaching contempt for men in popular culture, what are some examples that you would give them?
Well, look at the way in which fathers are presented in, let's say, TV sitcoms or ads on or commercials. You know, fathers are always shown as being stupid and bungling, and it's always the mother who knows how to do things. So that's one example.
You know what is the perfect? Let me just tell you, the one I always think about is Family Guy.
Yes, or Homer Simpson.
Exactly. And they're the same kind of ones. And of course, those are cartoons for adults. And the smartest person in Family Guy is the dog.
Yeah.
You know, so dogs are smart. Babies are smart. Adult parents, particularly fathers, are not. Okay, what's another example?
Well, Catherine and I analyzed, this was the first book in the series, and Catherine and I analyzed a whole lot of popular movies and romance novels and jokes and comic strips and TV news shows. Now, this was about, well, 25 or 30 years ago, but there were enough that what we intended to do was write one introductory chapter and use these as symptoms of an underlying problem. But we had so much material that we published one whole volume on that.
Wow.
And we found that the general pattern was that major male characters in all of these productions were either evil or inadequate or both. There were usually, but not always, there were token men, usually black or gay, who somehow escaped from that and that characterization, and they were basically honorary women. But the major male characters were evil or inadequate or both. So we just found so much of that. Now, I should add, you know, that to say that misandry is out there doesn't mean that we think misogyny isn't out there. They're both out there. These two phenomena are just continue to coexist.
Let me ask you, so when you were doing this first part of the book, looking at the culture and how men have been demeaned, and I think most people who are of a certain age would not have a hard time agreeing with that. when did you see it start to really change dramatically?
Change in what way?
Culturally speaking, and I'm talking mostly about movies and television and pop culture. Before, I could take a guess, but I think you have a much better understanding of it. When you watch old movies, say, for example, on Turner Classic Movies, it's easy to tell when it wasn't like that. John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart and the great heroes, manly types who took care of their families, who were concerned about ethics and integrity and hard work and taking responsibility for your behavior. And they were the kind of characters that people certainly in World War II looked up to.
Yeah.
So when did you really see it change?
Well, I think that the common factor in all the men that you've just described is that they were men. They were not teenage boys. and many of the cultural icons at the moment, whether they're actually 18 or 38, they're basically teenage boys. Now, when did it begin to change? Well, I would say in the 1960s, probably. In the 1950s, you had a show like Father Knows Best, which is the one show that every feminist wants to hate, because it presented a father as somebody who was respectable, somebody who could be respected. At the same time, mind you, there was Ozzie and Harriet, and Ozzie Nelson was depicted as a well-meaning but bumbling figure, and his legacy was the one that continued, not the one of Father Knows Best. And in the 1960s, everybody was rebelling, and the idea that that young men had to conform to the stereotypes of their fathers, and be, you know, wear suits and ties and go to work and business, they rejected all that. Around the same time, or even earlier, in fact, then women began rebelling against the stereotypes that had afflicted them, as they would have said. So that was some. Now, okay. Part of this, and a large part of it, had to do with the introduction of the birth control pill, because that right. suddenly made it possible for women to enjoy sex without worrying about the consequences. And so the idea that both men and women wanted as much sex as possible and enjoyed it, that was something that took root among both men and women in general. But after about 10 or 15 years, women began to rethink that, and they began to see that it didn't quite work for women in the way that they thought that it would. They were still afraid of sex, but they were afraid of it for other reasons. They were afraid of it because they were, who could tell what was in somebody else's mind? They didn't know what consent was. There were all sorts of problems that have sort of boiled up and boiled over.
They've also been told that they're supposed to react to sex the same way as men, and they don't. And they were told that men and women are the same.
That was another problem.
Exactly. I mean, and
so that along with Playboy, Hugh Hefner's project, there was the Cosmo Girl, which was Helen Gurley Brown's project. And the two together gave the impression that men and women were, for all intents and purposes, identical. And it wasn't only in popular culture. I mean, in terms of employment, too. At first, it was, you know, men and women were the same, and if women didn't fit in the right employment pattern, then it was all their fault. Women didn't really want to have children. They wanted to be at work. These were the kind of standard tropes that were used. Now, all of those things have come under question, but instead of looking at themselves and saying, well, you know, are women responsible for any of this confusion or accountable for any of it, they've simply said, no, it's all men's fault.
Let's stop there for a minute. We're going to have to take a break. I just want to throw out this one last thing before I do, because I got a floating break. And that is, remember in the 70s when women were told that they should want Alan Alda, that sensitive man, rather than Tom Selleck?
Right.
And if you watched Gone with the Wind and you're of that generation, you could always tell which were the women. You know, you could tell so much about a woman by their prototype. And most women, the prototypes of Ashley Wilkes and Rhett Butler.
Yeah.
I mean, what could be a more clear delineation between the prototypes, you know? And most women in those years loved Rhett Butler. And Ashley Wilkes wasn't appealing at all. We couldn't understand why would Scarlett want a guy like him. But we were sold a bill of goods and told that Alan Alda was the perfect sensitive, sweet man with feelings, right?
Yes,
to me,
of course.
That was like the second chapter in trying to demasculate men. Am I wrong?
No, you're pointing out something interesting, but I would just add that Gone with the Wind has continued to be controversial for many reasons, but one of the reasons being that famous scene in which he carries her up to bed and has his way with her. And so you have some feminists today saying, well, that was an example of rape. And other women who are saying, no, she enjoyed it. And, you know, there's all this confusion.
It's the difference between being ravished and being raped. Very, very different. Listen, you are a fascinating guest, and I cannot wait to get into the meat of this here, which is about misandry. And is there a war on men, and why? We're going to take a break. Thank you for staying with us, Dr. Paul Nathanson. And we're going to come right back. This is Spouting Off on BBS Radio Station 1. Please stay with us.
Hi, I'm Hadley, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the great principle of equality set forth by the Declaration of Independence.
The great Abraham Lincoln described the Constitution as a picture or frame of silver, built to guard or protect an apple of gold. This apple of gold was the Declaration of Independence and its principle of equal rights for all. This principle of equal rights, Lincoln said, clears the path for all, gives hope to all, and by consequence, enterprise and industry to all. There are many today who seek to limit or distort this great principle by employing a distorted definition of equality, an equality of condition or outcome, regardless how people live their lives. This distortion, if generally accepted, will lead to an America less prosperous and less free.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/AskAuntEmma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/AskAuntEmma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital, starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
It is April 17th, 2018, if you're listening live. And this show, by the way, is going to go all over the place. We never know all the different places it's going to go. When it goes off to podcast land, it could live forever. I am delighted to have with me as my guest, Dr. Paul Nathanson, an academic cultural analyst. And we are talking about misandry, and that is the contempt for men in the popular culture, which is a portion of the name of his book. Dr. Nathanson, We were talking about the culture, and you told me off air that you had a lot to say about boys and men and how they form their cultural identity. Tell us more about that.
Okay, well, in an article that I just published, I talked about the Me Too movement and the pros and cons of it. You know, it's a good thing for women to be able to talk about things that they find very disturbing. And I'm certainly not here to say that it's a good thing to intimidate or rape women. And there are problems with the Me Too movement also, namely undermining the rule of law.
I couldn't agree more.
The second part of my paper was on something that I call identity harassment. And I see it as a functional parallel to sexual harassment. Identity harassment is what we would all recognize as the blaming and shaming of men, to the point not only of blaming men for all of the, you know, significant problems that women have or that anyone has, but even the most trivial things. I mean, we now have man-spreading, the idea that men take up too much room in buses, or
mansplaining.
See, these are really pretty trivial things, and in fact, they really have equivalents among women as well. It's almost as if, well, if you've exhausted all the really horrible things that men do, you just you invent something else to you know.
That
really
seems to be the
far.
Case.
And I think, you know,
yes.
as an academic, I can tell you that, you know, the male students that, that I've known over the past 10 years or so have become increasingly passive, listless. They don't do their work. They're not interested. They don't have ambition. Basically, they're giving up. Why are so many of these young men giving up? Why do we have a suicide rate that is so much higher than that of women, a dropout rate? What's going on with these people? And I think that it's because they have a hard time forming a healthy identity as men. And let me tell you what I think a healthy identity is for either an individual or a group. A healthy identity is the ability to make at least one contribution to the larger world that is A, distinctive, B, necessary, and C, publicly valued. And if you can't make a contribution of that kind, then you cannot have a healthy identity. And if you can't have a healthy identity, then some people will say, well, okay, we'll take a negative identity, thank you very much. And these are the people who abandon society. These are the people who become amoral or antisocial. So there is a huge problem out there. One of the common factors among the high school shooters, for example, there's a high correlation between them and having no fathers in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is that fathers have a crucial role in the home, in the family, and it's not the same as the role of mothers. Fathers are not assistant mothers. They're something quite different. So if you have a society such as ours, which actively undermines the notion that fathers are a significant part of family life, trivializes fatherhood, even demonizes fatherhood, then we will never solve the problem, because I think that the only way that boys and men can form a healthy identity is through fatherhood.
Well,
and I say that because the other traditional ways in which they formed identity as men, provider and protector, have basically become obsolete in the sense that women can and do function in those ways either on their own or with help from the state. And so they're no longer distinctively masculine. They're no longer necessary for men, and therefore they have no they're not publicly valued for men.
Well, you brought up exactly. I'm going to skip over some of the other questions I was going to get to because you brought up exactly where I wanted to take you, where I wanted to go. And that is because you are from Canada and you have probably not that you agree with everything politically in Canada, but in America, it seems to me, and I'd love your thoughts on this, that the war on men and the misandry that we are talking about has some very distinctive motives behind it. You mentioned that women have help from the state. If you are a socialist, then you want to encourage more women to be alienated from men so that they can become a new victim group, a new voting bloc, and be new dependents on the state. I don't know if you saw the commercial, a political commercial about Julia, who depends on the state from cradle to grave. And when you've run out of LGBTQ XYZ and the politically correct alphabet ABCs, you've got to create a new victim group. And you have to create a new group that is going to be more dependent on the state. The least dependent on the state are resilient, competitive, assertive men. Tell me what you think about that theory.
Well, I don't think that anybody wants to create new victim classes. I think that that happens as a result of factors that, we can go into. Ideological feminists who have really become mainstream in the past few months. I mean, that's one big change that's taken place. 10 years ago, the idea that we live in a rape culture was something that you heard on college campuses, but it wasn't mainstream. Well, now it's mainstream. So the people who are behind that, yes, they really do want to see women as victims in order to make it to get the political payoff. Because if you're a victim, then automatically you deserve help.
That's right.
I wouldn't accuse feminists in general of that, but there certainly are some who do.
Well, I'm not talking about, just to be clear, I'm not talking about any one individual who, this is more of a motive that I am presenting for why these cultural changes keep happening that we only can see, and it's understandable, in hindsight, which of course is 2020.
Exactly.
And you can see
happened with no-fault divorce. You know, 40 years ago, people said, well, you know, why should people be forced to live with each other, make it easy for them? It's the compassionate thing to do. Okay, well, but nobody thought really about what would happen to the children.
Yes, but,
today,
but see, what I'm submitting...
The results are in. Children of divorce are really doing very badly.
I'm asking you to take it one step further. Maybe you could do some research on this and we could talk again about how the cultural changes. I am not suggesting that the average feminist who is persuaded by some of these cultural changes, and I would submit has been co-opted by those cultural changes. What I'm suggesting is that there has been a socialist agenda since the 60s to attack the nuclear family, to attack American values, to attack anything and everything. We are seeing it on steroids right now in almost every aspect of American life. And you can tell me how it's different in Canada, but the socialist, it's no longer a dirty word in America to be a socialist or a communist. And those socialists and communists are behind every victim group you can name, including Black Lives Matter, including the Pussy Hat Rebellion the day after Donald Trump. All of it has been to attack everything that has made America the unique, exceptional country that it is. self-sufficiency. In fact, what men, and even I must tell you, football is the perfect prototype for America, not because it's violent, but because it values self-sufficiency, competitiveness, assertiveness, being held accountable. And they hate anything that symbolizes that, including men and football and self-sufficiency. That's my point. I mean, look at the Oscars, right? They actually elevated the statue because he was penis free.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm getting passionate here only because I care so much about this issue. And here you've been writing about it all along. I mean, it is so important for us to look at what a lot of people have bought into. Sorry.
Well, you know, one thing that I've found is that among our supporters, that is Catherine and me.
Yes.
One of our biggest groups of supporters are women who have sons.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of men are still shell-shocked. They're not as articulate about, although this is changing. But a lot of women are saying, well, what does this mean for my son?
It doesn't bode well.
Good question. And, you know, they need... They are looking for something desperately.
Yeah. We are going to wrap it up. I would like people to, before it's too late, tell people where they can get your books, where they can read you. Are you on Twitter? Are you on Facebook? How can they contact you?
No, but the books are all on Amazon.
Okay. And if they'd like to respond or comment, is there a way that they can reach you online?
Well, they can just contact the publisher who will give them my email address, and I would welcome that. I mean, you know, intersexual dialogue is one of our basic principles, and I answer all my mail, always.
Wow. You don't have an email address that you're willing to put on the air?
Yes, I can tell you right now.
Okay, I don't want you to get it. Not that you'll be inundated, but of course we hope you are.
I hope
I
am.
That you're inundated.
All right. The email address is wordwatcher with W.
Great.
At videotron, TRON, at .ca.
Okay, great. Let's say that again.
Wordwatcher.
Walker.
Watcher.
Oh, Word Watcher. Oh,
that's
what a
it.
Great title. Okay.
I do freelance editing, that's why.
Okay. So it's Word Watcher.
Videotron.ca.
.ca, as in Canada.
As in Canada.
Great. We have we got a lot of good thinkers coming up from Canada, including the sensation, Dr. Peterson.
Yes, Jordan Peterson.
Yes. Do you know him?
I haven't met him, but I've certainly heard his videos, and he's an interesting guy.
And so that's another reason why I think it's so cool to have you on, because there's always, with one action, there's a reaction. And when the leftist culture, socialist, which I think they jumped the shark a long time ago, on race, on gender, on all of this identity politics, totally throwing the idea of an individual out the window, you see people coming up like yourself and like Dr. Jordan Peterson. So we applaud you guys, and we applaud, and we want to hear more from Canadian, brilliance to talk about some of these things so we don't fall into the trap of just buying into it. Maybe I'll have to have you on in another, quarter, in next quarter or something, and talk about the Me Too movement, because the Me Too movement, in my opinion, is deadly dangerous because
wrote an article on it, which I would like people to read.
Please tell me, where can they find it?
It's an online journal. It's called New Male Studies.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Because what they're doing is making women all good and men all bad, just in time for the midterm elections. It's happening in Colorado and Wyoming and all over. People are being told you have to vote for the woman because she's good, and the men are bad, right? Okay, go ahead, say that again. Say that again, and we'll have to close.
Okay, new male studies, and it's the most recent issue. They can find it. It's an online journal. It's not hard to find.
Very, very good. We're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Paul Nathanson, thanks for being with us. If you'd like to get a hold of me, if you have questions or thoughts on this broadcast, if you want to spout off, you can get me by going to www.karencataline.com. Same name / Karen Cataline on Facebook or on Twitter. Thanks to my producer, Doug, at BBS Radio. And thanks to HW, the guy with the IQ greater than that of a small soap dish. Tune in next week when there's going to be a whole lot more to spout off about here on Spouting Off.